I'm Mark Purcell, and this is Cincinnati Edition. Time to go on the money with Chris DeSimeo and his guest Peter Sorrentino from Huntington Funds.
The volatility continued on Wall Street last week, a full week of trading that kicked off Monday with a decline of over 200 points. The volatility index spiked, and traders very concerned about the goings-on across the pond in Italy, of all places, where the election results were not exactly what the markets had hoped for. However, as the week continued to move forward, markets rallied with big gains on Wednesday and Tuesday, and flirting with the all-time record high on Thursday before a final fade in the last 15 minutes that kept February's results somewhat more muted than they otherwise would have been. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Peter Sorrentino, a chartered financial analyst, a cagey veteran with what, 30 years now in the investment business?
Indeed.
Yes, and Peter, frequently seen on Bloomberg and CNBC. He was on CNBC after the close on Thursday and manages money at Huntington Investment Advisors. And Pete, thanks for taking part of your weekend to be with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. Peter, how can we have the kind of rally that the markets had? The Standard & Poor's 500's up, what, 5, 6, 7%? I mean, it's, you know, it changes so much with all these 100-point moves. But how can a rally like this exist side by side with all the concerns over the sequester? How can these items not be mutually exclusive?
Chris, that's one of the questions that really haunts us at this point in time. We saw a lot of money that had basically gone out of the market in the fourth quarter for capital gains to capitalize on that the lower tax rate. That money repatriated itself early on in January, and we haven't seen that big asset shift from fixed income into equities. So we're kind of wondering when this rally runs out of gas. And as you pointed out, we got a little bit of a warning shot across the bow with the results in Italy, because what hit there was they had a 10-year bond auction that followed right on the heels of that election, and those yields spiked up. And usually the bond guys are much smarter than the equity guys. So when the bond guys head for the exits, the equity guys are wise to watch. So that was the stutter step that we got early in the week. But then all was forgiven, and the bond market just kept chugging right along. So we're still wondering what's driving this this rally in the market.
Yeah, I guess it's maybe was it the idea that everyone thought that Berlusconi had really gone away, and there here he is back again. Was it one of those where'd he come from moments on Monday?
This is almost like the Saturday Night Live thing where Generalissimo Francisco Franco is still dead. But it's amazing. We saw that event 2 weeks ago that really passed without any notice whatsoever, where the Irish basically took their IOU from the Central Bank of Europe and essentially flipped that over and monetized their debt, issued 20 and 40-year debt, something the Maastricht Treaty forbids them from doing. But in effect, they did it. The bond market let them get away with it. And so, you know, everyone's wondering, it's like, is Europe really fixed, or are we just waiting for the final shoe to drop in that scenario? And again, the bond guys are smarter than the stock guys, so we're really braced for that moment.
So keep an eye on those yields in Italy, Spain, and other European countries then.
I think that's going to come back and haunt us.
Yeah, speaking of bond markets, there has been a good deal of talk that the bond market, and, you know, drum roll, you know, we need dark music right here, is somehow about to blow up, that there's a bond market bubble. And I think our listeners and the investing public in general are not well served for people to generally describe the bond market as one thing. The bond market overall is huge, but it's broken up into several different and distinct parts. Is there a bubble in government bonds? And if it does blow up, what is the likely outcome for investors in this country?
Really, when you look at the credit markets, and you're right, there's the liquid market that basically locked up, and that's what brought us the financial crisis of 5 years ago. But the bond market itself, those events take place over relatively long periods. And if we look back at just the 200 years of history in the United States of issuing debt, these interest rate bottoms are saucer-shaped affairs. They go on for years.
Saucer-shaped, not V-shaped.
Not V-shaped. That's usually an interest rate spike, which we saw in the early 80s, because they strangle themselves off. So demand for credit dies once you hit a certain point. But interest rates don't have to come up. And when they do, they generally rise at a fairly slow, you know, rather measured pace. So it's not as though there's going to be some apocalyptic moment. It's just going to simply be that we'll see rates begin to grind higher and higher, some of which has already begun. We've seen it in mortgage rates. We've seen it in some incidental rates around the periphery. It started to happen.
In the yield area. A lot of investors are looking for income, people who are not willing to tolerate the almost capricious swings in stock prices. Where are you at Huntington Investment Advisors recommending that investors look to get a steady, predictable, reliable stream of income? Is it the muni world? Is it high yield? Or are these master limited partnerships that were on the cover of Barron's last week? Are these areas that investors who are craving income should be investigating?
One of the problems has been is that all of the places where we professionals used to avail ourselves of to create income for customers, you touched on master limited partnerships, real estate investment trusts were others, the junk bond high yield area had been another. Those have all become very popular now, and so the fear is they've become too popular. To a major extent, we've gone back to the really global blue chips, if you will, not just domestic,
Okay. Very
large cap companies with fortress balance sheets, good histories of increasing dividends, very stable dividends. Those are the kind of companies that we've tried to go with. As you point out, a lot of customers aren't comfortable with that. So municipal bond land. Now, here you have to really do your credit homework.
More dark music.
Again, more dark music.
Some big minor chord right here.
Yeah, there is the news coming out of California, Illinois point out, there's a lot of issues out there haunting some of these states and municipalities. But if you do your homework, there are bonds out there in the municipal world. In Ohio, the water and sewer bonds are great because they have taxing power. They can go after property. So we always view those as sort of backdoor general obligation bonds. So if you do your homework, Muniland does offer you some hope right now.
The interest rate environment doesn't really favor short-term investing. I mean, what do you define as in muni world as long-term, mid-term, and how important is, if you're looking at individual bonds, how important is the dreaded call feature that we haven't talked about for a long time?
Oh, I know. With falling interest rates, that really has been an issue because every local treasurer has basically been rolling off his high coupon debt, using his call provisions and running it lower. We tend to focus in really that 3 to 7 year category because beyond that, you're tying up money for an extraordinary period of time and a lot of things can happen. You capture an awful lot of the yield advantage in the 3 to 7 year category. So we tend to stay focused there. My crystal ball doesn't really run out any farther than that, so I tend to try to keep customers in that area.
Okay, and there are individual securities, there are actively managed mutual funds, and even some exchange-traded funds that specialize in that particular spot.
Yes, and those are always, the ones where if you do your homework, you can find, there's usually an option there.
You know, it's interesting, when you think of where we were 5 years ago, you referred to the liquidity, the drying up, or actually just grinding to a halt, and the credit crunch that triggered this huge decline in equity prices back. Hard to believe it's been 5 years, and then the bottoming out 4 years ago. 4 years ago next week, March 9th. Here we are witnessing recoveries, apparent recoveries in housing, apparent recoveries in manufacturing. Auto sales are rising higher. Are these recoveries sustainable in your opinion, and if they do have legs, what are the risks to these to sustaining these rallies and recoveries in those important industries?
Chris, this is one of the things that haunts us right now is that we've seen corporate productivity and profitability really reach their zenith levels that that historically have signaled basically an inflection point where things turn down. When we look at the housing market, we have seen new construction pick back up, but there's a whole shadow inventory out there of short sales that are now starting to come into the marketplace. So, to get too excited about these basically would be to ignore the demographics that, our population growth is slowing. And so a lot of the traditional growth engines of the economy aren't going to deliver the kind of boost that they used to. Hurricane Sandy, one of the side effects of that is we're going to see a lot of car sales and you're going to see some building and that's going to make some numbers look good for a while.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, that echelon of 24 to 32-year-olds who form households and drive economies, ours is going to grow, but it's only going to grow at about 1% from this point forward.
Okay, so all those cars that we saw bobbing up and down in the backwaters of Brooklyn, those have to be replaced. But once that is done, and then we get to a more normalized, slower recovery in these items.
Yes, then it's basically we're back down to the replacement cycle plus population growth, and those aren't exciting numbers.
You bring up population growth. It's a really important trend because in many of the world's developed economies, populations are not growing rapidly. Japan has been struggling with this for a long time, and that we look at the emerging markets, and you would hope to see big news out of China. But last week, China's Purchasing Managers Index figures, their PMI was just knocked over 50. Is that something to be alarmed about, or was that just their economy slowing down as they took a couple weeks off, however long their New Year's off, to usher in the year of the snake?
Yes, the Lunar New Year is a much bigger deal there than our New Year. We get it over in one evening, and they tend to drag it out for a while. No, there are some structural issues in China. They have still a lot of state-owned enterprises that are effectively bankrupt but still existing, so a lot of zombie companies over there. They've got issues with regards to their population, because their one-child policy, that's going to come back and haunt them as well. So, you know, China is not a growth story into the perpetual future. And I know last year the big theme, and this is something Mark Mobius at Templeton talked about, was really North Africa and Africa in general may be the growth engine of the next 20 years.
Yeah, pay attention to that area. Resource rich, and they do seem to be attracting quite a bit of capital. Peter, this has gone by so quickly. Once again, I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Peter Sorrentino from Huntington Advisors, and for Cincinnati Edition, I'm Chris DeSimeo on The Money.